You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Galway Kinnell, and I'm honored to have him here on the occasion of a visit to read in the UCLA poetry season. His most recent book, published by Knopf, is When One Has Lived a Long Time Alone. It's the most recent of quite a few well-known and beloved books of poetry. I think he first came to public attention with his book, Body Rags. I know that I had quite a few poems memorized from the Book of Nightmares. He wrote The Avenue Bearing the Initial of Christ into the New World, Mortal Acts, Mortal Words, which were largely poems about marriage and family, his selected poems, which I believe won the Pulitzer Prize, The Past, and now the new volume, When One Has Lived a Long Time Alone. Thank you for coming and being with us, Galway.
Well, it's a pleasure. I like the song with which your program began today, at least, because really that's what I believe, that we are animals, and we're just one species among our fellow species, and many of our troubles perhaps come from our supposition that we're basically not one of the family of animals, but some anomalous godlike being.
This godlike being seems to be, if poetic, capable of praise, which seems in this book to be one of the great virtues of poetry, title of a book by Robert Haas as well. I wondered if you saw that as, in the midst of the darkness that inhabits your work centrally, whether praise isn't a primary function of the poet.
Well, yeah. I don't know if I would say praise so much as poetry is the human being's song of being here, as a bird's cry or any animal's cry is.
In the room, you talk about the horror of having, and realize in the course of that poem that having is being in some sense, even having nothing. I notice in these poems and in several of your interviews talk about renunciation and a kind of monk-like existence of the poet, living with as little as possible, and that this was once the poetic sense of vocation, a sense of vocation that was once, you know, made the poet exemplary or admirable. In these times in which renunciation or surrender or sacrifice seem so rare, do you feel the poet is further away from the world than ever before?
Well, I don't know if I've ever believed in sacrifice, really. I don't think so. I think an existence in which we don't waste things, in which we live in such a way as to get our needs, whatever they may be, and but not more than what we need, is what I advocate. I don't think I've ever wanted to live a truly hermit's existence, although I have at some time or another. It hasn't been for the sake of the hermit-like existence, but for some other reason, for some kind of experience of solitary thinking.
In solitude, which seems to be the theme of this book, seems almost as if the opening poems, which are poems of about death, especially the death of the father and the experience of the distance of the father, especially a father who seems not to speak, to have had a tongue that won't talk. By the end of the book, the poet is alone and seemingly unspeaking. Is this a sort of association with the father?
Well, well, not really, because the... although it's true, at the end, the poet, let's call him the poet, is alone. Still, he's talking, almost, whereas the father was a silent, unsinging, untalking person. And the poem ends with a kind of, well, wishful passage, hopeful passage about how natural and desirable it would be to rejoin the species.
If such a thing were ever possible, or if it were possible, in fact, to detach, do you think that... I was reading earlier today your introduction to the essential Walt Whitman. It's been a career-long identification with Whitman, and you talked a bit about Whitman's declining powers, that as he lapsed into his role of the good gray poet, his revisionary impulses were perhaps more conservative than barbaric, and that his poems sometimes, at least, lapsed into a kind of dull goodness. How does a poet prevent that decline? Can it be prevented?
Well, many poets have prevented it or not gone through it. So, yes, it can be prevented. Just exactly how, I don't know. But the thing about Whitman is he began to, in my opinion, take on a a kind of protective stance and tried to make himself more more desirable to the world and to become a popular poet. Whereas when he first started, he may have had those ambitions, but he was reckless and spontaneous and spoke some truths that nobody had ever said in poetry before and that no doubt startled him himself. Whereas later he became much more commonplace as a poet. So maybe it's just the same for everybody in life, that it's better not to stay put, but to keep pushing forward into some kind of knowledge of what life is all about. I suppose Yeats is a great example of a poet who did that.
The critic Jeffrey Hartman suggested in a very odd book called The Unremarkable Wordsworth that at a certain point, having demonstrated the range of poetic power, that Wordsworth set about to explore unremarkable utterance, virtually unpoetic, that there would be in so vital a poet an equal yearning really to explore not the tongues of the common folk, but the tongues of the dead, the tongues that get caught up in the inability to speak. Mm-hmm. It seemed to me to be such a peculiar idea, but it did remind me of something that Donald Barthelme had once said to me, that anyone could write a good sentence, but to write a bad sentence, to write a perfectly awful sentence, was really the poet's inner ear's job.
Well, an awful sentence, but a true one. right. I think the greatest problem with poets is, like Whitman's, and like Wordsworth's, something you might call inhibition. Inhibitions about self-exploration and about saying things embarrassing to the self. That's what I meant by a defensive stance. And I think what distinguishes a poet from somebody who's not a poet more than anything else is not facility with language, but it is the ability to say anything, which implies the ability to, maybe the intelligence and the courage to know anything, to know the things you don't want to know, and to be able to say them. I don't mean that poetry has to be, ugly and terrible, but I would imagine that if you can't say the ugly, you may not really be able to say the beautiful too, because you would probably tend to make the beautiful, too sweet and pure to be real. I think both of that Wordsworth and Whitman both, suffered from this problem.
I'm interested here, perhaps this is a diversion, of late a certain kind of contemporary poetry, post-Stevens, Ashbery, say, has become terrifically abstract and with the desire to find a way to say the unthinkable, the unwordable thing. Not the unspeakably obscene, but literally for language to comment, say, on its own process, mm-hmm. or to invent its own sublimity and then talk about it. Your poetry, on the other hand, has always been very starkly and austerely interested in communicating and speaking to others, even about an inability to speak from time to time. What is the nature for you of communication for the poet?
I'm not sure that I that I'm any different in that respect from, say, John Ashbery in terms of communication, because when I'm writing a poem, I'm certainly not thinking, is this communicating to anybody? I don't have any. I have only myself, myself reversed as my reader. I'm trying to be absolutely clear as I can possibly be, but the only measure of the clarity is my own standards of clarity. I'm never thinking, can I go into the supermarket, or can I go into the English department or wherever, and will I be understood? Not at all. And I imagine Ashbery thinks the same thing. He just wants to be as clear as he can. I think, probably the difference is that the kinds of explorations that he makes are quite a different kind from the ones I make, because mine tend to go into, problems of living that everybody recognizes, that people in the supermarket or in the English department actually go through, whereas John is going into areas that not everybody recognizes as an unexplored world. That's really the exciting part of his work.
Do you think that you mentioned in the essay on Whitman that Whitman's tendencies toward revision were not always good ones? I know that you have gone through many revisions of your poems, often revising them for subsequent editions. What prompts a later revision?
By a later revision, all revisions are inherently later, but by later one you mean
after
very much
later. After
the
publication of the poem, yes. Uh-huh.
Well, Whitman made we could call later revisions. In one edition, the poem appears in one way, and then the next, suddenly there are five lines missing. But if you look at those five lines that are missing, they are lines about his inner experience that he may have thought, I blurted out something terrible about how I feel about my father or about one thing or another, really embarrassing about adolescent experience or whatever. In my case, when I'm revising, I try to put those five lines in that Whitman took out.
I see. Revision toward greater embarrassment.
That's it.
Mm-hmm. Is it ever the case that someone taps you on the shoulder and says, Galway, you have not gone far enough?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is it friends or other poets or just the process of reading about the country?
Well, of course, I have friends who are engaged in the same enterprise as me, and they, I often show them my work and they tap me on the shoulders and say, you haven't gone far enough here or there. But I tap myself on the shoulder too, and so that starts me revising.
It's an interesting thing. I think, many of the novelists I speak to on the show, I find myself saying to them that the show provides a model, perhaps, of a kind of literary conversation that may exist nowhere else. But my sense is that among the company of poets, that such conversation continues to exist, that there is still, to some extent, even under the perhaps benighted auspices of a writing program, a community of poets. I know when I went and visited Squaw Valley earlier last year, that I was delighted to see the kind of conversation that I found missing in my own life, I think, ever since I've left schools.
Sure, there's a lot of talk in the writing programs, but really, poets, I don't think poets have ever often written in solitude. And when they did, they suffered from it. I think Dickinson and Whitman are obviously the two most shocking examples of poets who didn't have a friend who was a poet, or even who read poetry. So poets have always been friends, and my closest friends are poets. And when we meet, we talk about particular poems that we wrote or that somebody else wrote, and we talk about poetry in general. And so we do have literary conversations. I remember driving once somewhere with a novelist and a poet, and the novelist was sitting in the front seat overhearing the conversation we were having in the back seat. And at the end of the trip, he said, "Wow," he said, we novelists never talk to each other like that."
Well, one of the purposes, of this particular show, I think that to some extent, interviews are frequently there in this format to convince listeners that writers are like everyone else. But since that's not my belief, I think that this show is there to convince people that writers are different from everyone else, that the thought patterning and thought process is odd, that the times when someone in anger says, but the poet couldn't have thought that, the chances are that, yes, the poet did. the pleasure of a truly other kind of mind. But, of course, that otherness is a frightening state of affairs. It's hard to be, to some extent, stranded in one's own language. And I thought I'd illustrate that unhappy state by asking you to read several of the pieces in the title sequence of the new book, When One Has Lived a Long Time Alone, which enacts extreme privacy and eventually moves and makes gestures toward the outside world.
I don't think I write about the plight of the person locked in language at all. I think I write about what everybody experiences. To me, if it has any, if what I write has any value, it lies in the possibility that just an ordinary person reading this poem will say, "Yes, that's how it is." But nobody ever let me see it before. So I'll read three sections from this poem when one has lived a long time alone. The first, and then one in the middle, and the final one. When one has lived a long time alone, one refrains from swatting the fly and lets him go, and one hesitates to strike the mosquito, though more than willing to slap the flesh under her, and one lifts the toad from the pit too deep to hop out of and carries him to the grass without minding the poisoned urine he slicks his body with, and one envelops in a towel the swift who fell down the chimney and knocks herself against window glass and releases her outside and watches her fly free, a lifeline flung at reality when one has lived a long time alone. When one has lived a long time alone, one likes alike the pig who brooks no deferment of gratification and the porcupine or thorned pig who enters the cellar but not the house itself because of eating down the cellar stairs on the way up. And one likes the worm who, by bunching herself together and expanding, works her way through the ground, no less than the butterfly who totters full of worry among the daylilies as they darken. And more, one finds one likes any other species better than one's own, which has gone amok, making one self-estranged when one has lived a long time alone. All right. When one has lived a long time alone, one wants to live again among men and women, to return to that place where one's ties with the human broke, where the disquiet of death, and now also of history, glimmers its firelight on faces, where the gaze of the new baby looks past the gaze of the great granny, and where lovers speak on lips blousy from kissing, that language the same in each mouth, and like birds at daybreak, blether the song that is both earth's and heaven's, until the sun has risen, and they stand in a halo of being made one. Kingdom come when one has lived a long time alone.
That was Gawain Tunnell reading three sections from the title sequence of his new book, When One Has Lived a Long Time Alone, published by Alfred A. Knopf. You know, when I was reading in this book some of the early poems about the father, about the thought that the brick, whether the neutron bomb exists or not, will still outlast the flesh, about the father running from his worries and cares toward death, hoping to get to death before the cares killed him, I thought to myself, you know, there are certain kinds of perceptions that one does not survive. Do you know what I mean? How does a poet coat himself enough to understand those things without being destroyed by them?
I know what you mean. I think there are some poets who, and I'm not one of them, actually. I think that in my case, poetry and the knowledge I've come to through it has led me in the direction of health and wholeness. I think, you know, for me, in any case, personally, I think that, for me, personally, I think that knowledge in itself is a good by which, if I'm to be saved, I will be. But I think there are poets who, I think there's a certain risk in the terrible knowledge. And some poets, in order to understand what's really awful about life, take it into themselves, exacerbate it and nourish it. And then they can say it more authoritatively than anybody ever said it before, but they can't escape. They die. I'm thinking the two names that come to me at once are Sylvia Plath and John Berryman. The thing is that, so they were kind of sacrificial figures in my imagination of their work. But what they do is gives health to others, because when somebody when somebody thinks about these terrible things, such as, let's say, total defeat and the wish to die, and reads a poem of Berryman's in which she expresses total defeat and the need to die, that's actually reassuring to another person to think, well, actually, another person, somebody else, Berryman, felt this way. And it's, I think that then, I knew a person who carried around such a poem of Berryman's as a talisman against suicide. So poetry, even the worst poetry, has a healing power by making other people know that they're not alone, that many other people, that it's human to suffer these things, sometimes just in a mood, sometimes in a passing moment. The thing about Plath and Berryman was that they seized upon these passing moments and held them and wanted to understand them fully and could not escape.
You know, I once was sitting with someone who, being myself a very nervous and easily frightened type, although sometimes not, someone took out his wallet and showed me a piece of paper on which the three words were written. The words were disastrous but not fatal, four words. This may be part of the warding off quality of poetry itself. I've been speaking to Galway Connell. The newest book by Galway Connell is When One Has Lived a Long Time Alone, recently published by Alfred A. Knopf. Thank you for coming with us this afternoon and joining us on Bookworm.
Well, thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.